Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody, and welcome to La Femme Depose. My name is Karen Allen, and my guest today is the Honorable Mary Elizabeth Bullock. What a story she has to tell. Judge Mary Elizabeth Bullock, are you with us today?
Yes, I am, Karen. Thank you.
I'm so happy that you are joining us. Judge Bullock has written a book called Judging Me, and it's a fast read. You really can't put it down, but her life is incredible. Her journey, which I know, if to hear it from her, she's still on a journey. She's never stopped. Her childhood of torture, sexual abuse, her ongoing quest for judgment and morals and ethics and forgiveness and, I don't know, it just doesn't end. And becoming a judge and triumphing through all that and getting to where she is today. I'll let her tell it. Thanks for joining us so much today, Judge Bullock. I don't even know where to start, but start off with where you ended up, where you started, and how you ended up an incredible judge, retired judge now, and what you have done to pursue justice, even as you yourself became a federal civil rights judge, having to sue the people in the government who actually are supposed to stand up for equality, the EEOC. But start off with your terrible childhood, because it was incredibly abusive, and how you even got through that to become a mother, a wife, and triumph career-wise as well.
Thank you. I'll start with I was the oldest of five children. We were extremely poor because I was the oldest of five, and I cannot tell you why my father decided that I was the one he would violently sexually abuse, not just sexually abuse, but violently. And I guess he figured that violence was the only way to knock me into submission. But he raped me, I mean, sometimes twice a day. He'd go through the motions of hitting me over the head, locking me in closets. I never had regular food. He took Skippy dog food and made hamburger patties out of it, and that's what I had to eat. The other four children were saw what happened to me, and subsequently, as you know, if you grow up in a dysfunctional family, even though you may not be the target, you suffer psychological abuse. There was certainly a lot of physical abuse that they went through, but they had to witness what I went through, and that was, I think, the most traumatizing of all. So I'm not the only one who was singled out. He had his own special torture for each child. But and I will say that, you know, that what happened to them was very tragic. They either died of heroin addictions. My brother was sent to prison because of his own heroin addiction and deciding to get the money through robberies. So the tragedy about my brother is that he was only a year behind me. And as a result, he did try and help me out. But the blows from my father actually kept him from helping me. And then many, many years later, after he got out of prison and was working and doing really good, he was murdered. I was handling a case which had a lot of political implications, and he was taken out. And I suppose the message to me was I should stop representing these women. But instead, I just showed up in court and said, as long as I have a pencil and paper and my voice, I'm still showing up every day. And that no one could stop me from doing that. It was very, very tragic. Just after he got his life back together.
Heartbreaking to hear that. your siblings suffered as
they
well.
Did.
From like
they did.
Starting from such a terrible father. No child, no human being, no child should ever start their life off this way. This is it's horrific. And was he ever brought to justice?
My father? No. No, he wasn't. Had I been a couple years older.
And where was your mother in all this?
My mother was silent. When I told her about what was happening, she slapped me across the face and denied it and then just turned up the TV set louder because I said, don't you hear me screaming? And so she just turned the TV set up louder so she couldn't hear me. And that was that. She never spoke to me.
That is incomprehensible and just impossible to comprehend again as your other siblings. I mean, how could anyone even survive such a family where she is equally as guilty by ignoring it on purpose? There's just
right.
No unforgivable.
I don't write much.
That,
right.
Go ahead.
I don't write much about her in my book simply because I have nieces and nephews where she did actually take care of them and raise them. And once my father was gone, she came into her own, so to speak, but I was already damaged and off to college, actually. So it was a huge disappointment to me that she could be there for them and never for me. She didn't even
was
talk
she
to her
abused
heart.
Herself?
I don't believe so.
Was she also
I believe she suffered from a huge depression based on my father's actions and inactions. So I
very sad.
Yes, it was very sad. I was
having
also trafficked.
That, you made some that's trafficking as we know now more about it because it's so incredibly pervasive everywhere that people don't recognize how incredibly common it is and how it's everywhere. That's awful. But I'm glad that you got away somehow because it's very hard to get away and to rejuvenate your life. And you did that and more so. But you did make some awful choices in men afterwards, which you write about. I won't make you talk about those horrible
Oh, no, that's
years.
All right. No, I actually did make some terrible choices in men. But when you look at the abused woman cycle, it's almost everyone I talk to that's been abused picks someone like their father. They don't look like him. They're in a different profession. Initially, they don't act like them. But then there's something about the chemistry of the two of you together that brings out whatever dark side they have. It's a dynamic that I can't tell you what the chemistry is, how across the room with a vector-like force, I could pick out a man who is exactly like my father just from looking
right.
across
and,
the room.
That's incredibly sad. And you did find your own. You did choose a man, and you did have a couple kids.
I did.
Who you're very
and they're
proud
beautiful.
Of today.
Yes, I'm very proud of them. They're
sadly, you became a young widow because your wonderful husband, who you did love, died young, relatively.
Yes, young and very tragically.
I'm so sorry about that because it seems like tragedy follows you because you also have some pretty serious illnesses. You suffer from MS?
MS
and lupus.
And lupus. Mm-hmm.
You had ovarian cancer?
I did. I
and
did.
You're still alive, though. You're still alive. You're still around.
Still kicking and
you,
still with a sense of humor. So.
Which you need, which we all need. But you decided to pursue the law. Talk about your career, because that is huge.
Well, I always knew my brothers and sisters chose drugs as a way of numbing the pain and trying to get away from the family. I chose education. I felt if I could just do well enough in school that I would live a fair life, that life would be good. And I was also very spiritual, and that helped me get to where I could tolerate anything. So I studied very hard in high school. I got a scholarship to the University of San Diego, and it was a wonderful school. And from there, I received an MBA. I went back to school later. I taught high school, and then I went and applied to law school. And that was the reason I chose law school was that after my MBA, I had run in an election and had won, and it was for a public utilities spot. And then I, and that came because I was so mad at my gas and electric bill that I, and my grandmother was the same way. She couldn't see the fat on the bacon, and she's the reason why there's plastic over the bacon today. So you can see it because she raised such a fight in Congress. But, you know, and for me it was SDG&E. I remember getting this $700 bill, and we weren't even home that month. And I called SDG&E, and they told me they didn't make mistakes. And I said, you don't make mistakes? I said, everyone makes mistakes. And so that was the line all the way down. And I said, you know, something needs to be done about these people. And so I ran in this election for this free position so I could do something about that.
You said when you were 7 years old, you knew you wanted to be a judge.
Yes, absolutely. Although my father was very discouraging, my whole family was, of course, and they didn't really care what I wanted to be. I mean, they just said, you'll never amount to anything, you know, because my father said, you'll always be my whore. And I knew that I was not. I knew I was getting out, but I had to do it my way, which was through school. And once I left, I never went back at all. I lived with my grandparents for a while, a very short while, and then I lived in a foster home with some really wonderful people. So I was very grateful for that. And then my foster father got sick. I had to go back home. And that's when my father raped me with the president notice of the senior class. And I never went to school my senior year. I was too embarrassed. But I went to college, and I wanted to be a judge. And I'm not a political person, and I certainly didn't pay to play. So it really was amazing when I got a phone call from the EEOC. Now, the kind of cases I handled as a lawyer were all discrimination cases. And I came before the EEOC on a regular basis to represent complainants. You know, they were usually pretty violent cases where the sexual harassment was, I mean, beyond belief. And sometimes they were assault and rape cases as well. So I did that, and then I got a phone call from the EEOC asking if I would please apply, for they had a judicial opening. And I did apply, and of course, nothing for me ever goes in a straight line. The woman who was in charge of the applications read mine and said she has no background in federal government, so that she put it in the trash. And then my boss came around looking for it. He said, where is Miss Bullock's application? And she said, well, I threw it in the trash. He said, unbelievable. Either pull it back out again if you can find it, or have her submit another one. So I had to submit another one, and I was selected. And it was next to the birth of my children and passing the bar the first time. It was a really momentous occasion because it was, I had hoped to eradicate any kind of discrimination, which was alive and well, and still is, just as much, but very covert today. So I was very, very happy. I had to move to Los Angeles, which is where the federal district office is, and I loved what I did. A problem arose, probably my I was in the hospital with ovarian cancer, just had surgery probably 12 to 24 hours after surgery. I received a phone call from my office telling me that I had to get into the office. And I said, well, I really can't. I'm tethered down by, you know, both arms with IVs. And I just said, I'm medicated, and I really can't come in. So they said, get in here. Well, I came by ambulance to the federal building, and I went up to see what was happening, and they told me that I needed to change a decision. Before I went into the hospital, I asked my boss, was there any old cases that were sitting around in his office that he needed some help on? And he said, yes, I do have one. And it was two women who worked for the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. And what happened was these women were attorneys, and it was a case about equal pay, discrimination based on Asian origin. And even though my boss had heard the case 7 years before, he never wrote a decision. Well, the chairwoman just happened to be, who was appointed by the president, the chairwoman just happened to be talking to one of these women, and the woman said, you know what, I had a case before the EEOC, and I never received a decision. She said, well, 7 years, you had to receive something. She said, no, we didn't receive anything, and my colleague sued as well. We were both in the same lawsuit, and we never heard anything. So that was the case that I had. I had finished it before I went in the hospital. I found in favor of the women and against the SEC. And that was, the telephone call came from the chairwoman saying, you know, whatever you do, the women cannot win. She said, I don't want my sister agency to suffer. Because as you know, if there's a finding of discrimination, there's damages to be awarded. And she said, I just don't want my sister agency to suffer. And as a result...
Judge Bullock, are you telling me the agency, which is supposed to be in charge of equality and equity in the workplace, is getting... And how long have you been there? How many years have you been there by then?
I had been there probably 3.
Okay, and they're getting you out of surgery.
Just post-surgery.
In your sick bed. Post-surgery, sick bed, they're getting you out of your sick bed to change a decision that you had made in your job as a judge. Because
right, I had never been overturned.
The government did, right. You'd
never
been
I'd never been overturned.
Asking you to change a decision so that
absolutely.
The agency of the government would not have to pay damages because you were finding that there was discrimination and they didn't like that finding. That's just mind-boggling.
Well,
and you
it
refused to do it. Is that correct?
I did. I said it's illegal and unethical, and I won't do it. I said that's a perfectly, as you know, good decision. It was 60-some-odd pages long with footnotes, and I just said I'm not doing it. The evidence showed that they were discriminated against, and I can't and won't change it. They said, yes, it's good law, but it's just it's politically not going to work. So, and this,
so that just
this
shows
is,
you how politics works in this country, I guess, which is very sad. But wasn't that the beginning of the end of you at the EEOC and headlines then roared?
Yes, it was.
I sued because
I had MS, which they knew when they hired me, and it was affecting my vision. And so I needed reasonable accommodations. And, of course, we wrote the law about reasonable accommodations and the ADA at that time, Americans Disabilities Act, and they refused to accommodate me. It was 4 years of doctor's letters and, you know, my request, and they would not accommodate me. They were just silent. So I finally had to sue. And it was, you know, the Wall Street Journal called it the most ironic lawsuit ever, that you'd think that those that wrote the law would know better. But it seems that one of their own judges challenged them, and they lost. So as a result, I was probably in court a total of 13 years before there was any justice, and even then there was precious little. But then I had lost my job. They went after my license with a bold-faced lie, and without due process, had my license suspended, which is my livelihood. They did whatever they could to destroy me, and quite nearly did. It was probably worse than what my father did, in that I felt that they were raping me all over again, you know, in public, and just leaving me to bleed there. And it was one of the most horrible experiences I've ever had. You would think that the EEOC would know better, but they didn't.
Well, they did know better. They just didn't care, it sounds like. Not that I was there, but they didn't want that decision going forward. Just because we only have a few more minutes left in the show, what did that do to your life and career? Because even though you, this took years and years, with what happened to your pay, what happened to your career, what happened to your life, your illness, what happened to your family, what happened to you? Because the Wall Street Journal and other, you know, you were in the media. You were, in a way, a superstar.
Well, I don't know about that, but I was very vocal about it because I was just so shocked and appalled that they would change the decision. I always thought that the judiciary was the last bastion of a place where you would get help from, and it turned out that it's not, that decisions are changed, and that oftentimes judges write decisions that are biased because they're pro-agency and not pro-complainant. So you have to be real careful, you know, to look at some of these decisions and make sure they're accurate, which I had to redo some of the judges' decisions because actually in effect they ruled incorrectly. But what happened to my family, I just about lost everything. And financially I was stripped. You know, my license was suspended. I mean, really, it took everything I had to rebuild my life again. And I focused on those children who were sexually abused and sex trafficking victims. And just received 2 weeks ago the Global Goodwill Ambassadorship for my work.
Congratulations.
Thank you. With sexually abused children.
Because you never stopped.
No, I couldn't.
You never stopped. I mean, this book, which I want to repeat to people, it's called Judging Me, One Woman's Journey from Abuse and Betrayal to Triumph. Because even though it nearly destroyed you, you stood up for what's right. And now of all times, in 2018, more people have to stand up for what is right. Not that I'm lecturing. I just think that
well, you
have
to
stand up for what they know is right.
Right.
Otherwise,
well, you have to do it. We're all challenges. You know, where are we is that we still live in a society where, you know, those who should stand up are silent because they're afraid of losing their jobs.
Yeah.
And they don't want to end up like me. And a 13-year
exactly.
court battle.
It's too much to lose, I guess, when you have a family or whatever excuses, and those are... It's true, those excuses are real people that a family you have to feed, but that doesn't excuse doing what's wrong, what's morally, ethically, and against the law, and even if you're part of the government, you have to do the right thing. Otherwise, what do we have? We don't have anything. We don't have anything to live on if we do the wrong thing, and the dishonest thing, and it's against the law. How did you keep it together, and how do you today, considering all your illnesses, all that you've been through, and all the attacks and death threats you've had? You were still proved right. You were proven right, and you won. You don't want your job back, and they wouldn't be treating you right anyway. How did you keep it together? And I know this book that you wrote the book, that had to be cathartic, but very difficult.
Well, it wasn't really cathartic for me. It was a real struggle to try and put into words what I had experienced. But I felt that I had a message, and so did my children, who were very supportive. They said, Mom, you need to write this book. And I did, And it's whatever I've been able to do, you know, it helps those who have been sexually abused. And just the reviews on Amazon made me cry because they were so from the heart. And they were just incredible, incredible people. And how I found the will to go on, I go back to, I'm a very spiritual person. I try and wake up every day and be positive and say, what's one small step that I can do today to make the world a better place? And I've just kind of surrendered my work and, you know, finances, whatever, to God, and He hasn't let me down. So I still pay my rent, and which sometimes I wonder how. I still pay for, you know, an assistant who's also a part caretaker, caregiver. So it's been hard, but it's been, I feel, necessary. And as long as I can take the debris of my life, fashion it in such a way that it helps one other person, then what happened to me was tolerable.
There are lots of things. If you Google Judge Mary Elizabeth Bullock, you can see on YouTube interviews, you can see lots of information. And your book is on Amazon, Judging Me. What do you want to leave people with today? Should they go for the law? Should they become attorneys? Should they become judges?
I would say no. The legal profession today is the last blood sport in America. It used to be in the 80s and the 90s that you fought for the market share. You're 51% versus leaving the other guy with 49. Today, though, it's not just a blood sport, but it's leaving your opponent dead, buried, and so he never rises again. And it's so full of, unethical and illegal behavior from people who, you know, if it's federal and it's the Department of Justice, I mean, they are some of the best liars ever. And, you know, Department of Justice attorneys become judges. And it's an old boys club. It's never going to change. As a matter of fact, when I went to court, you know, I realized that the judge who was hearing my case had been a former DOJ attorney, Department of Justice. And I knew that between the two of them, you know, this was an old boys club. And I told them, I said, of which I'm not a member. So I said, but I understand the fraternity, and I just hope that you don't apply those same biases and prejudice to my case. And we didn't have to go before them because we settled eventually. But I would leave people with, no, I don't think attorneys are the way to go about it. I mean, we earn the jokes righteously, although I would never paint all judges and all attorneys with the same broad brushstroke, because there's really good ones out there. But what I would say is that there is precious little justice, but that if you stand up, if we all stood up for what is the right thing to do at the right time for the right reason, our world would be a far better place.
Well, I didn't want to get into the Me Too movement so much. I am remiss on that a little bit because you are a woman, and perhaps you were treated a certain way because you were a woman or not. But that's a whole other show probably. But your case is fascinating, and keep on standing up for what you believe in and what's ethically and morally correct, and for the law, because that's what you did. So I'll leave people with this. The name of the book is Judging Me by Mary Elizabeth Bullock, the Honorable. Mom, Grandma, thank you so much for joining us, Judge Bullock, and all the best to you.
Thank you. You're welcome, and I enjoy being on today's show. Thank you for having me.
The book is available on Amazon, and again, Google her, because there's so much out there online, that interviews and other things that Judge Bullock talks about her journey, and there's a lot more you can say in the half an hour that we just had online right now. It's fascinating. It's absolutely a fascinating story, and Judge, you've been through hell and come out of it. So I admire you, and keep moving forward and keep setting a fantastic example. Thanks, everybody. for listening to La Femme de Prose. I am Karen Allen, and we will hear you, see you, and hope to join us next time. Bye-bye, everybody. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Judge.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.